Okay, this is the Abhayasutta. On right speech and skillful compassion. On one occasion, the Buddha was staying at the squirrel's sanctuary in the bamboo forest near Rajagaha. A local prince, Prince Abhaya, went to the Jain Nagantha Nataputta. The prince approached Nagantha Nataputta, bowed, and sat to one side. Nagantha Nataputta said to Prince Abhaya, "If you would refute the teachings of the mighty and powerful Gotama the contemplative, an admirable reputation of you will spread far." "Venerable sir, how will I refute the teachings of the mighty and powerful Gotama?" "Come now, Prince. Gotama the contemplative is at the squirrel sanctuary in the bamboo forest near Rajagaha. When you see him, ask him this: would you say words that are not endearing or disagreeable to others?" If he answers that he would say words that are not endearing or are disagreeable to others, then you say to him, "Then how is there any difference between you and ordinary run-of-the-mill people?" "However, Prince, if Gotama the contemplative answers that he would not say words that are not endearing or disagreeable to others, then you say to him, then why did you say that Devadatta is headed for deprivation, a living hell, beyond redemption?" Devadatta was upset at these words. Devadatta was the Buddha's cousin, I think, who was in the Sangha for quite a while and then attempted to kill the Buddha and take all the Sangha members. He failed. "When you ask Gotama the contemplative this two-pronged question, he won't be able to swallow it or spit it out. It will be as if he swallowed a two-horned chestnut that has become stuck in his throat." Prince Abhaya responds, "As you say, Lord." He left Nagantha Nataputta with respect and went on to the Buddha. On arrival, he bowed and sat to one side. As the prince was sitting with the Buddha, he thought, "This is not the time or place to confront Gotama the contemplative. I will invite him to my house and refute his words there." "Great teacher, would you join me with three of your Sangha members at tomorrow's meal?" The Buddha accepted the offer by his silence. The prince left with a show of respect. The next day, the Buddha adjusted his inner robe and took his alms bowl and outer robe and left for Prince Abhaya's home. Upon arrival, he sat on a seat prepared for him. Prince Abhaya served the Buddha and his friends a lavish meal. The Buddha finished his meal and removed his hand from his bowl. The prince then sat on a lower seat to one side of the Buddha and addressed the Buddha. "Would you say words that are not endearing or disagreeable?" The Buddha responds, "There is no categorical yes or no answer to your questions." "Well, Gotama, you have just refuted the Nagantas. Just yesterday, Nagantha Nataputta told me to find you and ask you if you would use words that are not endearing or are disagreeable. He said you would choke on the answer as if you had swallowed a two-horned chestnut." At that time, a baby was lying on the prince's lap. The Buddha asked the prince Abhaya if this baby was if this baby was neglected and swallowed a piece of gravel, what would you do? "I would remove it. If I could not remove it easily, then I would hold his head with one hand and reach into the baby's throat to remove the stone. This may hurt the baby, but would save his life. I would do this out of sympathy for the baby." "In the same way, Prince," Buddha's words, "in the case of words that the Tathagata knows to be unfactual, untrue, unbeneficial, or not connected with the goal, Unendearing and disagreeable to others, he does not say them. In the case of words that the Tathagata knows to be factual, true, unbeneficial, unendearing, and disagreeable to others, he does not say them. In the case of words that the Tathagata knows to be factual, true, beneficial, but unendearing and disagreeable to others, he has a sense of the proper time for saying them. In the case of words that the Tathagata knows to be unfactual, untrue, unbeneficial, but endearing and agreeable to others, he does not say them. In the case of words the Tathagata knows to be factual, true, unbeneficial, but endearing and agreeable to others, he does not say them. In the case of words that the Tathagata knows to be factual, true, beneficial, endearing, and agreeable to others, he has a sense of the proper time for saying them. Why is that? Because the Tathagata has sympathy for living beings. The sutta. So again, it's pretty clear right speech is this teaching is talking about right speech. And the practice of the Eightfold Path is the development of restraint. The practice of restraint is the development of the Eightfold Path. Restraint and moderation in speech is the middle way. So, can all of you think of an example of something that is factual, true, beneficial, but unendearing and disagreeable to others that you would have the proper, you would understand the proper timing in delivering that kind of speech? I don't know. I think all of you do. I think everyone has that understanding. And we do that as best we can when we can recognize that. And, when we think about right speech and its place in the development of the Eightfold Path and its place in this teaching with regard to sorry, I just had to admit some folks here. With regard to restraint, what is the countenance and conduct of people who practice in this way? Who have the proper sense of timing to deliver things that might upset someone if you told them. The Karaniya Metta Sutta describes such a person: peaceful, calm, wise, and skillful. So when we, through our development of the Eightfold Path, through the development of restraint through practicing the Eightfold Path, that is the countenance and conduct that comes through. Peaceful and calm and wise and skillful. Guess I'll go online here. Kevin.
Thanks for the teaching tonight, Matt. Well, you got a full house there. I don't think I have anything to share. I like you did a really good job with timing in this sutta, the way you delivered it, and Thank you for that.
Thanks, my friend. Hey, Raquel.
Hey, Matt. Can you hear me?
I can. Were you able to get in on any of that?
No, I was waiting in the lobby, but it's okay.
Sorry.
I will listen to the recording and to the comments. I will observe the noble silence. Thank you.
Thank you. I was almost going to just do it all again.
I know that's the second time you do this to me, but that's okay.
Sorry.
We're going to have to chime back in.
Yeah, we do need the chime. Yeah. All right. Jane.
Hi, Matt. Thank you for the teaching. When I read this, I thought of the case where someone is suffering, you know, either a loss or is going through something really hard. And the inclination would be to tell them, you know, everything's going to be all right. And really the more skillful thing to do would be to acknowledge the dukkha, right? Acknowledge what's happening. And just say, you know, I'll be there for you or something to that nature, rather than just saying something to make you feel better. So that's what came to my mind.
Yeah. Thank you, Jane. Yeah, absolutely. That's, you know, that's something for us all to notice too, is when we interact with each other and speak with each other, with family or friends or anything, how much we are internally considering what someone else might think or feel if I say something that they might not like, or, and then in turn I change my behavior to accommodate what I think they might think, and then forget it. You're done. It's all gone. You've just fabricated this entire scenario in your imagination, and you didn't even communicate directly with the person. So that's a form of lying, I'd say. So would be wrong speech in that way. So that's something that we can look at in our own relationships, in our own speech with each other and with loved ones and in our relationships.
It could also be a case where silence is not noble.
Right. Right. Yeah.
It takes a level of great concentration and mindfulness to be able to navigate that.
Yeah,
that's part of the practical uses of in our householder roles. So just always intertwines the entire ego with that.
Thank you, Jane. Jeff.
Thanks for the teaching. It was well done. Following up on what Jane was saying, I picked the phrase out of sympathy out of the sutta to remind myself that you're not there to make agreeable conversation or to rescue people, but to try to, as I understand it, try to promote or lead people to understanding of the Four Noble Truths or the Dhamma. And it seems culturally, you know, we're kind of programmed to try to provide, I don't know what you, consoling words that often don't really have any real substance or meaning to them. So it can be difficult, I think, right? To especially if you're dealing, in most cases, at least in my experience with people without any background in the.
Spinning. Sorry, I really got into that. Jeff, it froze up a little bit.
Let's see that.
Jeff, if you want to close your window and come back in, I'll let you in.
Used to flip the screen to use the camera. That way you can see where you're aiming.
Nice.
That you can see it, but we can.
All right.
All right, while we're waiting for Jeff, Brian.
Thank you, my friend. If it's not true, not beneficial, and not timely, don't say it. And I found that most of my conversations these days and the role that I play are unpleasant and difficult. But I still have them. And I think Jeff was onto something with out of sympathy for others.
Yeah.
People need to hear hard things. But again, you don't tell them lies. You don't tell them things that are negative. You don't tell them when it's not the right time. But you do that out of a calm, concentrated mind is a radically different conversation. And those difficult conversations, when they're coming from a place of authenticity, resonate deeply with other people. And you're right, you get wrapped up in this narrative that has absolutely nothing to do with reality, that's usually far worse than the actual conversation itself.
Exactly.
Right? And not beneficial to you or the other person. So I think it's these words are timeless. And once you start getting out of your own way, you're right, all of your relationships become that much more meaningful. Thank you.
Thank you, my friend. We'll go around the room. I'll wait for Jeff to come back too, because I want to give him and Deborah a chance to speak again. Gonna have to practice restraint with this spinny thing.
Yeah, there are a couple to touch on out of sympathy. That is one side of another thing that comes up in the Karaniya Metta Sutta, and that is there ill will? Mm. So when you have a new bad news to impart on somebody, and sometimes to tell them that their perception of themselves is not quite, it doesn't quite touch with reality. Those conversations where you have to say things that are not endearing. Mm-hmm. The question you have to ask yourself is there any ill will here in me? Am I really saying this out of sympathy? Mm-hmm. Because there's some fuzzy edges to that that exchange. And I think that's one of the reasons why the whole center section of Karaniya Metta Sutta is about there is no room for ill will. Mm-hmm. at all, ever, anywhere, if you want to, you know, attain the goal. In conversations like this that are where you have to say things that are not endearing, that's the touchstone. Is this truly out of sympathy? And when you can answer that question in the positive, then that conversation becomes easier. Once you have cleared that conflict out of your mind, A, you'll be heard better, because that will come across.
Yeah. Thank you, Ron. Just see if these guys are back. Trace?
I think I'll take note of silence.
Thank you for being here. Zach?
Yeah, for me, right speech is all about right intention. And I found that so much of my speech is kind of falling to the wayside, because I found that a lot of my speech was just propping up ego self. You know, our conversations have changed a lot. Because there's no need for it anymore.
Thank you. Tim.
There's a lot of nuance with speech. As I've been practicing the Dhamma all these years, I've realized that the awareness of those arising emotions in the conversation typically indicates an ego. And having that restraint is so beneficial in teachings like that. And just recognizing the Eightfold Path as that middle way, as that path that guide. Having a 20-year-old daughter, certainly, I get a lot of practice. And it's pretty much about it, though. But I think for me, it's about awareness. Where is that person that I'm speaking to able to take anything that's going to come? I'm going to try to convey. If there's delusion or there's any type of emotion, I mean, there's no point.
Right.
And then at that point, am I ingratiating myself for my own ego?
Right.
To be right.
Yeah.
Or to be intelligent.
Yeah.
Who cares? Because the point is not to have ill will and to be compassionate. So sometimes just kind of nodding and going, and move on.
One knows the proper time.
Right. But it's hard. I mean, it takes so, I mean, every type of situation is so different, so nuanced.
Mm-hmm.
And it's sometimes it's a winner, sometimes it's a loser. And the best thing to do for me is not to beat myself up if it's goes wrong.
Yeah. So. Good. Thank you, Tim. Yeah. I mean, that's, you know, you make a good point there in that. We're all householders and we're all, you know, finding our way on the path and off and on and off and on. And, you know, that's why it's called practice. And that's why it's called developing the Dhamma. You know, we're implicit in that is error. And, you know, we have to accept that.
Yeah, but when you see a conversation just bouncing off, you can actually say this is not right. This is, you know, and you know, offer to try it again, or you know, or to just admit that whatever just came out of your mouth wasn't the right thing.
And it puts into practice what is your quality of your mind.
Yeah.
You have to be engaged with that part of it, with the conversation. So if you are seeing something arise, you're saying, ill will is arising, or I just need to be heard. That's like the key to the conversation.
That's the awareness.
I see it myself. The Buddha obviously is an enlightened human being. So each one of those scenarios that he rolls out, he's a master of that, because he's a master of his mind, of the quality of his mind. Mm-hmm. So developing that mindfulness allows you to engage. We know when we're off rails. Mm-hmm. That's not necessarily you saying something that the problem. I'm not mindful of that moment.
Yeah. So, Michael.
My speech is kind of, you really have to be introspective before you impart anything. In Brooklyn, New York, my speech would be like, watch your mouth, right? And that's just basically what we're doing. But, we're not so quickly. But I just wrote a couple of things down here. Mindfulness of the internal dialogue. Speech is set forth from the mind. Okay, it's developed in the mind, comes forth from the mind. So the internal dialogue, which we've used, this also needs to be framed within the framework of the Eightfold Path. Okay, right here. Non-egoical, recognize the ego self in dialogue, Dhamma in the present moment, which is right here. What is the result of our words? What are our words? How are they going to impact who's there to listen to them? So that has to be factored in also, because words can move mountains. What does the moment require? Awareness of the impact of the words again. Also awareness of individual receiving such words again. Sometimes silence is best. He's not saying anything at all. If the moment is not there, then why?
Yeah, don't force it, right? Yeah.
Didn't the Buddha have that question about how do I impart this to the deluded, the delusional?
Yeah, I mean, he said, those with just a speck of dust in their eye, and up until that point, even should I do it at all? Yeah, thankfully he decided to, for our benefit. Thank you, Julia.
Thank you for the teaching, Matt. Pretty much like everyone else is saying, I agree. I especially like it when to recognize the moment. I mean, not every moment is a good moment to speak, especially if you see like the other person is somewhat inflamed. You have to choose the right moment, meaning that, like Michael just said, sometimes it's best just to be silent.
Yeah.
Because otherwise you do refuel the fire, and then the conversation is no longer productive in any way, and you can't impart any type of knowledge that you might want to, because the person is not listening anymore.
Yeah.
But I also think that it's very important to have right speech within, and that's for yourself, not just thinking of others, but also for yourself, to catch yourself.
To yourself.
Right, to yourself.
Yeah.
So that you stay present and you stay in acceptance of the present moment, instead of thinking of the past or the future and making all these fabrications and going off the rails yourself internally, just your own speech inside yourself. I mean, if you can control that, then you just took out that second chain of dependent origination,
yeah,
and you just stopped that whole process,
yeah.
from continuing. You know, I mean, that's difficult, but
yeah, that's
you catch it there. Mm-hmm. You know, internally.
That is a good point about the second link of the pen origination. You know, now you're as Julian said, like you're processing. You're aware of what could arise there at that second link. You know, so if you can not be self-referential or gullible, you know, in your mind, then what if you remove that link, the rest of the links fall off.
Yes.
Back up.
And yes, to both of that. I also want people to think about many people find themselves in the habit of self-censoring, and that is that is for sure not authentic and not right speech and won't allow for right speech. Because if you're constantly self-censoring in the idea that, well, I don't want to sound like I am doing the wrong thing or saying the wrong thing or you know, or I need to catch something here or there, then it doesn't allow for right speech.
And you're already not listening to the other person.
Right.
Because there's so much going on in your head that you have no chance of actually seeing the other person.
Exactly. And that's really the thing is that kind of self-censoring and internal considering doesn't allow the other person to really be authentic themselves, because you're trying to play both sides of the conversation in here. In your imagination, and that injures you for sure, and injures that other person, and in turn injures the relationship. So, you know, that kind of, you know, like David said, this is about and you know what you guys said, becoming aware of the quality of your mind and developing that awareness of quality of your mind so that you can go, oh, okay, you know.
And the driving force of right speech, action, livelihood, has to be right intention. That has to be the driving force of it. So what you just described is wrong view.
Right.
It's wrong intention.
Right.
To what you were saying, it has to be driven by that. And then the muscle of, how do I do this?
So, yeah.
I have to refine my mindfulness.
Yeah.
I have to transition from gross restraint to refined restraint.
Yeah.
And that's when the conversations that you're describing can occur naturally. And yeah. That's when really you're renouncing these things that just don't work.
Yeah.
All right. That's my cue. So as a recovering people pleaser. All of these, this discussion is, right. I mean, that's just what it is, right?
Oh, like
all
the
mental gymnastics of trying to anticipate what the other person wants to hear or how to make this as calm an environment as it is at much like damage to yourself, right? And not like being authentic. Not being honest and therefore being in wrong speech or wrong everything. So what's interesting for me, what's coming up for me, and I'm posing this as a question, the group, we don't ever really use the expression of self-actualization in here, mm-hmm. because I feel like a common definition for self-actualization is really based in ego. It's based in like, you know, you're trusting your consciousness or just, you know, lots of different caught links in dependent origination.
When I went out, you know, searching yourself, that was the basis.
Self-actualization.
It was all about self-actualization, finding yourself.
Okay, well, I want to find the better term.
So we're about 50 years out of date here.
Yeah, I heard. But what I'm wanting to say is that I need a better term than self-actualization for what this conversation is bringing up for me, mm-hmm. which is that by practicing right speech and being on the Eightfold Path, it's actually like this most wrong word, but concept really of being like most honest, authentic.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Thank you.
Yeah.
That's better.
The word Eckhart Tolle, pure consciousness.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you could, your instinct was correct in that you felt the just that the limitations provided by the Eightfold Path created a boundary that allowed you to develop understanding. And that resonates with the concept that you brought, that was like, hey, this really looks like that. It sounds, it's like that.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's not the 70s or whatever, you know, right. it's 2,600 years ago, a totally different.
I'll take pulling a chair. That's fine.
Yeah.
No,
totally.
And you start out with the word self.
Right.
And we're now going to fabricate a better self.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that is all like totally not the Eightfold Path, because, what we think of ourselves is not a self, you know. So how about we start giving up trying to make this self better or more authentic? And it's because it's a job that's doomed to fail. You're just making more of what was there before. You're trying to change it. And you're looking for some kind of an ideal. David is right. This is maturity. Mm-hmm. Maturity happens when stuff falls away. It doesn't happen when you start scooping things on there.
Yeah. And I think maybe this is like what's hard about language, is because I hear you.
Mm-hmm.
But I also know that I am becoming a better,
it's okay. You can say that. It's all right.
Well, I follow.
Yeah.
You're talking about the slowest change in how you think.
Yes.
And you're saying the same things.
Exactly.
You're just not, you'll know it. Like you said, you feel sick about people pleasing.
Mm-hmm.
But right view allows you essentially be saying the same things, but it's appropriate timing. It's beneficial.
Yep.
It falls into all these like tumbling things that the Buddha was laying out. And that's, to me, is like the purpose of the practice. You can have these conversations.
And it's like authenticity arises naturally from the limitations of the Eightfold Path and practicing and developing that. That just is a natural byproduct, like carbon dioxide, you know? It's just there.
Mm-hmm.
When that stuff, when all of the edifice falls away, then what's really there and is always there is there.
Yeah, I was gonna say
tool is recognized and abandoned.
Yeah.
And so, you know, as you abandon, as stuff falls away, you find out what's left. You know, and even that catches you by surprise.
Yeah.
When you realize there's no more conflict. You know, I can have an exchange with somebody. There's no conflict. I'm not I don't have to try anything.
Yeah, doesn't that come from compassion? I think that part of right speech is, has to have that component of compassion so that you recognize it.
Yes.
There is, and but there is that side of them wanting to please. So,
like true compassion.
That comes from right intention.
Right.
Yeah.
That's driven by right intention.
And that
class we were going over that.
That's right. And the thing is that just like authenticity or whatever else, compassion is naturally arising from right speech, mm-hmm. right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, right? All of those things. It's compassion just is like the byproduct.
It's appropriate compassion.
Yeah. I'm not doing compassion because that means I'm supposed to be nice to this person or something. Right. That's not it.
That's not real compassion.
Right. Tim.
I think what you're saying, I was thinking the same thing. And with, on my sutta, we were talking about these conditions.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Right? Mm-hmm. You know, and we were talking about the people pleasing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, is it for you? Not you, but is it for the ego?
Right, yeah.
You know, and I think it all comes down to that, for me at least. You know, that phony compassion is for the ego, and that's not compassion.
Right.
Right.
You know, and I think that's what the Buddha was saying.
Even if it turns out good.
Even if it turns out good.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter. Yes. It's just at the expense of somebody else.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, because it's for the ego.
Trace.
I just have a question for the group also. What if there's a relationship in your life that there's never a good time? Like, or you haven't been able to find a good time because the person that needs to hear the message refuses to hear.
Mm-hmm.
Do you abandon the effort to try? Because, like, well, I don't ever, like, I won't say who it is, but I don't ever see an opportunity where any of my right speech would be heard ever.
Mm-hmm.
Then it can't, it just has to be for you. It just has to be for you and not for them.
You only can do example. You have to just
it's do. It's like if I'm
worry about the person's reaction.
No, it can't be. If you're internally considering what they may or may not think or say or do based on what you may or may not say, then you're completely trying to play both sides of the conversation.
But what if you've had experience knowing how they're going to react?
Well, so for example, like
you have to be able to handle it.
Bingo. So,
yeah,
so
feelers, you can do little conversation
starters. That's hard. That's a hard thing.
Yeah, if they don't go anywhere, then you didn't stop there.
This is a habit. This is a habit of internally considering what and creating, trying to play both sides. That's an internal habit that develops, like people pleasing or anything like that. So, for example, this is totally hypothetical. My mother-in-law needs to have particular napkins on the table at Thanksgiving. And if those napkins aren't on the table at Thanksgiving, then we're going to have an issue. But I don't like those napkins, and I don't want to use those napkins.
And I may even accidentally have lost them.
Right? And so
this sounds awfully real.
No, I love my mother-in-law's napkins, but in this hypothetical situation, internally considering would look like I'm going to, because I know that she's going to have a tantrum if I don't put those napkins out there, and I don't want to deal, and I just don't want to deal with the conflict, then I'm going to contort myself in order to accommodate this other person's behavior. So now I've lied.
Yeah, this came up Saturday because it's like it turns into wise associations.
Mm-hmm.
Anthony brought it up, and it's sparked a whole same conversation. Just different versions.
I was an hour late to class.
Yeah, yeah. But it really is like you start lying.
Yeah.
Out of convenience.
Yes.
Or out of casually to avoid it. And
I want to get to everybody.
But the conflict starts with you because
exactly.
You don't like these napkins.
And it's sort of like that's families are just it's weird. So,
I didn't know it was a family.
Well, it's just that way. So it's just that way, and we train our nervous systems in a way to do these things, and it becomes a habit, and then after years and decades of running this habit, then I'm sick and I'm in pain and there's all kinds of stuff that can happen. But you have to be able to recognize and acknowledge when you have gone into that and go, oh, there I did it again.
Yeah.
I did it. You might not catch it. This is just like the awareness. This is just like the refined mindfulness that we develop on our cushion. So if you are committed to not lying anymore or not internally considering other people's reactions, then you will start to catch yourself going into that. And then you'll start, the more that you catch, be gentle with yourself, because you're attempting to do something that you've trained your nervous system for decades to do the opposite. So again, be gentle with yourself, because you're not going to catch it every time. But the more that you do, the less you will do that. And this person will then have a chance to see themselves in action and go, when they tantrum at you and you're just like, and then they're like, ugh, why did I do that?
Yeah.
It's not about the other person.
It's not. That's just what you'll observe if you take that practice up.
It's helpful. I think you have to recognize your contribution to what is occurring.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. Are you inflaming it? And there's different ways of inflaming the situation. You could do it like a very low key. In my experience, I would have a conversation with someone trying to gain headway, but then the individual actually kind of interfere with that in a very subtle manner. So you have to recognize, are you being subtle? Are you being truthful to yourself and having right speech yourself? Right speech is not a go-go. So you're looking for a solution. You're not looking to inflame the situation. So it's basically very introspective. Mm-hmm. And Zach was right what he actually said. It's not about what someone else is doing. It's about what are you doing. Okay. So if you're doing the most that you can do in the present moment, and you're self-aware, and nothing is occurring, nothing is working here, and you continuously find yourself banging your head against the wall, then, as David had mentioned, and what it comes to is, the question is this a wise association here? And it's an extremely difficult thing to come to and say, I don't know what I can do here.
Yeah.
Or?
I mean, don't argue about napkins.
Hey, I lost that argument.
It's not worth it.
Bring
on
that. What kind of napkins do you like? Whatever the ones my mother-in-law tells me to put on the table.
I was just wondering if you could clarify that last circumstance that the Buddha outlines, if it's beneficial, if it's factual, true, endearing, but then, you know, still a proper sense of timing, right? That's mm-hmm. the last. Mm-hmm. That one is a little bit less intuitive for me, but it kind of mm-hmm. is becoming more clear as I hear everyone talk tonight, and especially with wise association, like Michael and Julia were bringing up, because at what point am I just not seeking reconciliation with this person, but just kind of seeking conflict, and maybe the conversation just should not happen at all, you know?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And again, like, that's the thing, like, we all, we've all been around the block a little bit. You know, we've all been here on this planet for a little while. So we all have some sense of which battle we're going to pick, you know, with people. And, you know, I think, well, I'll read that last.
Yeah.
In the case of words that the Tathagata knows to be factual, true, beneficial, and endearing and agreeable to others, he has a sense of the proper time for saying them. Why is that? Because the Tathagata has sympathy for living beings. So, factual, true, beneficial, endearing, and agreeable.
And still, there needs to be the property.
Yeah. Yeah.
The impulse is just blurted out.
Right. Right. Because
if you think about your situation, that's a perfect example of that. That it's just not timing. The timing is not right, even though it's beneficial and it all falls into that. Sometimes it's just not time for it.
Yep.
And that's not lying.
Yes. Yeah. It will right. not be heard.
Right. It's appropriate. That's correct. Mm-hmm.
I was waving to Kevin, who's waving. But I.
Kevin's raising.
Sorry. Kev.
Yeah, I mean, so just in context of the structured study, we're sort of building from right view, you know, through the wisdom factors. Now we're at right speech, more or less. And to paraphrase our great teacher, John used to say, if you want to know the quality of your mind, notice what comes out of your mouth. I'll even take it further. Notice, you know, the considerations going on in your head or what's going on in your head. And what you've just described, like, I don't want to repeat, or I don't even know how you said it, but a lot of this answer just comes up in noble silence. You will not have that urge. You will know the time is right because you will be noticing the quality of your mind. You're practicing four foundations of mindfulness in the world. That is something that for this context of this discussion, nobody is bringing into any conversation, period, except for you, because we're practicing here. So you're going to notice that you just don't need to say anything. There's no words flying around. There's no thoughts flying around. And your compass is tuned in then. So I just wanted to share that. Thanks.
Well said, Kev. And that's right. In that, through noble silence, the proper timing will reveal itself. And then you can act appropriately and speak appropriately. Zach?
Can I just, because I hear John, again, John's words here as well. And I think a lot of this discussion needs to be put in the framework of truth, which is there's dukkha. And we are not here to be salvific.
Yeah.
Right. And so there are a lot of people in this world that I will never have agreement with on certain issues. Mm-hmm. It's not my responsibility to change their mind.
Mm-hmm.
And might that there's stress associated with that. Right. And but the closer it gets to home, the harder that is.
Yeah.
For sure.
Well, this was, anybody else have anything? I don't want to go too long.
We could go all night.
David?
I think so.
Michael?
Recognize your own condition, your own conditioning, because obviously our conditioning is from a corrupt consciousness, right? So you have to recognize that. So if it's from a corrupt consciousness, mm-hmm. that means it's ego-driven, right? So if you're not identifying with the ego, you have a much better chance at imparting the words of wisdom to the other individual or
such a place. When it comes down to you're looking for insight to the three market existence.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's what this is all about. Yep. This is slow it down so you can absolutely experience that.
Yeah.
And all those virtuous things will just naturally start occurring.
Yeah.
And timing will just become something that is included. Just there's a time and place.
Great discussion, everyone. Great class. We'll finish with meta as we always do. Gently close your eyes, gently close your mouth. Find your relaxed meditation posture. These are the Buddha's words from the Karaniya Metta Sutta, as restored by John Haspel. This is what is done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. They are able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied. They remain unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways. They are peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. They do not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. They are always mindful that all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born. They are always mindful not to deceive another or despise any being in any state. They abandon anger and ill will with ease, never wishing harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart, the wise disciple cherishes all living beings. They radiate kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, they maintain refined mindfulness. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, having completed the path, does not give birth to another moment rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths. Thanks, Elias.